Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Registered representative, securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Investment advisor representative, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Fujiyama Wealth Management and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Lee Cantor here with Junko Horvath. This is another episode of Junko's Health, Wealth, and Happiness Hour that's brought to you by our good friends at Fujiyama Wealth Management. Junko, how are you doing today?
Great. Yeah, weather is nice. Everything perfect.
So you like the fall?
Yeah, I love the fall.
The fall? Yeah. Better than the summer?
Better than summer. I don't like summer yet.
This is nice weather. Yeah. So fall and spring are your favorites.
Yeah.
And then what, winter?
And then winter, yeah.
Then summer lasts.
Summer lasts.
See, I'm the opposite. I like summer the best.
Oh, really?
I'm from Miami, Florida. Yeah. I like the heat.
Yeah, Scott too.
All right. Yeah. So tell us who you got today.
Okay, so today I have two wonderful guests, Scott Price, Chief Strategy and Transformation Officer from UPS, and Sebastian Mais, Baker Donaldson Atlanta office shareholder.
Oh, wow.
So I'm excited to get to know them.
All right. So let's kick it off with Scott. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to know exactly what you do, because I heard this is a brand new position at the UPS.
So thanks for having me on the show. So the Chief Strategy and Transformation Officer, about a week ago, my oldest daughter called me from New York and said, what is exactly that you do? So it's clearly not a title that is easy to understand. So UPS as a company has a history of transformation. We're 111 years old. We've transformed before. But the reason it's different this time is the pace of technological changes in the outside world, whether it be in the areas of technology of movement, which is autonomous vehicles or drones, whether it be the platforms that are changing the way people operate, whether they buy differently in terms of online. Everyone here is a big customer of some online provider. It just means that a company as large as UPS in the logistics industry needs to change. So we are in the midst of a refresh of our strategy and transforming the way we go to market. So my job is to coordinate that and go through that process. So it's great. Been in Atlanta 8 months. It's a great city. Mm-hmm. We lived outside the U.S. for 25 years, so very much enjoy getting to know Atlanta.
Wow. Are you using certain other countries as models for this transformation?
Interesting question. I think that the scale of the U.S. and the maturity of the economy means that the U.S. is actually becoming the model for other markets. You know, certainly if you think about population and density, et cetera, China is a very, very important market. But the growth of the China business is wildly different if you think about a tier one city like a Shanghai, a Beijing, a Guangzhou, a Shenzhen versus, say, villages in tier four.
Right.
America's rural is far more infrastructurally developed. And as a result, if you think from a logistics perspective, the U.S. is quite unique.
So how did you get started? So you are new here in town. So where were you?
I was working for a rather large retailer called Walmart. Prior to that, I was in the logistics industry, a company called DHL. But I actually started my career with Coca-Cola. So I was in Japan, actually, in 1989. I finished grad school. I speak Japanese. So I started in Japan for Coca-Cola. And in the 12 years I worked for Coke, I came to Atlanta once. So this is my second time. It took my time. Yes,
what's the impression, like a first impression, and actually when you live here now?
I actually thought it was just going to be a very nice southern city. My father's side of the family is from North Carolina, so I thought it would just be sort of a larger Charlotte. What we have found is Atlanta is a global city, both in terms of the access to things like the arts and various types of foods and the infrastructure, the arts, all of that is here, but it's also just the population. The diversity of the population is really quite exciting. So we have found it to be a great city. The only thing, it's just the traffic. Boy, was that an adjustment. You know, I used to think the commute in Hong Kong was bad. They've got nothing on Atlanta to and from the airport at 5 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it's really bad here. Yeah.
Now, when your title is also transformation officer, does that... is that referring to the transformation in the organization?
It's a end-to-end transformation. So if you think about transformation, it's kind of three buckets. So growth. So how the market changes means that we have to grow differently. So we have to transform our growth. So you think about our products, our services, our pricing. So that's one bucket. The second is cost. No company wins by being the highest costed player. So how do we look at technology? So the way we manage transactional activity and how you use AI and you use outsourcing as a mechanism to be able to reduce your cost to operate. But probably the most important is the third bucket, which is talent and culture. UPS has traditionally been a company that has promoted from within. The vast majority of our leadership started as a package car driver. So I was actually in 111 years history, the first outsider hired to come into the management committee as a signal of the shift in terms of how we think about balancing, certainly the importance of people who understand the company and the business. So people who are promoted from within, but an understanding with the speed of the outside world, we think about technology and you think about areas, we need to balance that with some mid-career hires. So individuals come in with different experiences. So one area around that whole area of talent is creating diversity of thought. And then culture is just the agility. We're a large scale company, 450,000 employees around the world, 220 countries. You got to be able to still be agile. So how do you create a culture so that people understand that they can take risks and that those risks are in a way that is relevant to where we're trying to head, but doesn't create too much risk for the total enterprise. So I have a great job.
But that's a tricky balance in a company that's been around for 100 years and historically has promoted from within. And then an outsider's coming in and saying, look, technology's happening so rapidly, we're going to have to be nimble and we're going to have to take risks. A lot of times that's kind of counter of how their entire career has been structured and their whole game plan. And so how do you kind of manage that fear that might occur in some of the employees saying, look, a drone, I'm delivering in the truck, and if that drone, some guy with a remote control is dropping a package down, how is that going to impact my job?
So I think there's three things. So first, let me start with the last. You know, the idea of drone delivery is conceptually quite interesting. We're way off from that being scalable.
But I mean, drone delivery may not be the best example, but drone inside of a warehouse is more likely.
And
it's
happening. Security. Right. We're using drones to do security, right? So if you think about the outskirts of large size facilities at 3 a.m, you want to make sure it's secure. You can use drones to do security. So there's really three things, Lee. So the first and the most important is the commitment of our CEO, David Abney. He has been with the company for 44 years, and he's the one who brought me from the outside, and he has been incredibly supportive of this process. So I give him a lot of credit for the success of the transformation program and process. The second is our people. You know, quite honestly, your perception was that there would be resistance. So the idea that I'm coming in and I'm bringing this enormous transformation process, frankly, all I'm doing is kind of structuring all the great ideas that existed internally anyway. So there's been a huge amount of support from the organization that says, look, we know we need to do these things. Help us figure out the way to balance that relative to the needs of our customers into the future. So that, you know, transformation isn't a strategy. Therefore, how do you reset your strategy? And then the third bucket is just, you know, my experiences. I've learned to adapt to new cultures. One of the reasons that I was really excited about UPS was that the culture of the company felt very familiar to me. It's one of kind of a family. It's collegial. It's not a shark tank. It's an organization where people come together cross-functionally to work on problems and not, you know, everyone trying to claim credit for it. And so it's that third piece, the unique culture of the company, that I think those three make it work.
That's great. So basically that you are outside like 25 years, that's really helped.
Well, they call a global citizen. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, the whole topic of diversity and minorities in the U.S., I was a minority for 25 years. I mean, I visually looked different than everyone else. And you know, I've experienced those things where My wife is from Japan. And so, you know, Japanese, we'd go to China and they would determine to talk to my wife, even though she doesn't speak Chinese either. And she'd speak to them in English and they'd rather talk to her than me. And I mean, it's just, you know, you feel these sort of, you know, these the micro messaging that comes from being different on the outside. I think one makes you adapt, but two, you create empathy for understanding how other people in that situation can feel.
Now, in the organization, in this time of so much disruption, historically, not a lot of companies have been able to withstand the they've been disrupted. They're not usually the disruptor. And you're trying to kind of flip the storyline here a little bit, right?
Well, I think there's two types of transformation, Lee. So the first type is from one of defense, which means that the decline and the disruption has already started and you're transforming to try and keep up. The second, and this is really more the case of UPS, is transforming from an offense. We are a very strong company. We have world-class ROIC, world-class margins, world-class people, but we see where the future is, and therefore we're making sure that we'll still be relevant another 20, 50, and 100 years from now, and not like well-known brands who have really struggled. And, you know, the companies that visually, you know, you think about Sears just declared bankruptcy again. And it's a large scale retailer that at one time was a disruptor.
Well, Sears was Amazon.
Sears was the original Amazon. I mean, if you go back, I mean, you know, I think we may not be too far off in years. I still even remember when I was a kid, the Sears catalog coming and using that for your Christmas shopping trip. That's the Amazon today. And somehow they got disrupted because they were not really clear what was going to be the future of how people buy and consume. Right.
So what do you do a lot of market research to see like a trend of the people and the trend of technologies? And
yeah, so we did a lot of work to understand mega trends that affect the logistics industry. I mean, there are a lot of mega trends that are happening out there, but sort of the mega trends that affect the logistic industry. So the first is the whole movement of business to consumer, so B2C. So it's not just Amazon, it's Walmart.com, it's Jet.com, it's Nordstrom's and Macy's. I mean, all of these companies have an enormous business. So what that means is that the economics of the transactions change. They used to come to the store and they would buy 15 things in sort of a stock-up trip. Now they go online and buy 15 different things in different times. Instead of the customer doing one thing, it just means now there's 15 boxes moving throughout the United States. So it's one, the massive growth that comes from that, but also the economics of it, because somehow we've all been treated to think that that's free. So you got to try and figure out how the economics of that movement matches and moves, that there's a fair sharing of the profitability of that. B2B is even being disrupted. You know, in the old days, you know, the B2B transaction would be long-term commitments that would then move across the oceans in containers. The container would be broken into pallets and the pallets would go to a store. Now you've got each is flying around the world because people buy single. They don't buy that far in advance. And then if you think even farther out, the whole area of 3D printing. And I've been to a 3D printing farm. There's parts that are now being made at a 3D farm, at a 3D printing farm, that no longer have to be kept stock in inventory. And so the impact of technology and what that will do to the future of B2B movements is also something. So that whole shift to eaches in the world is a massive shift. Urbanization is another shift. So if you think about that great brown package driver of UPS, the complexity of trying to deliver in urban areas becomes more and more difficult, both for residential, but as well commercial. Traffics weren't thought of, So, you know, the one thing that everyone should hope for is that autonomous vehicles reduces the amount of traffic in the world so that, you know, package car drivers have a much easier time doing their jobs.
Are there soon going to be like UPS scooters? Going to paint them all brown?
We already have them. We've got bicycles. We've got scooters. We've got hand things. You should see some of the things that we do in Europe.
I'm sure. That,
both green and as well reflective. There's parts of, you know, so Holland, for example, and Amsterdam, you can't take package cars into many parts of the city. So we've had to come up with green scooters. We've come up with bicycles. I, in fact, had a chance to I was in, where was I recently? London. I was one of our facilities in London, and they had a new something that they're thinking that we're going to use, a brown trailer that's pulled by a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And so they let me get on the bicycle. it was free exercise.
So now for you and your career and having traveled, how is that, how have you incorporated that for your personal life? Is that just part of your life now? Is you're a global citizen and then traveling is just part of how you live your life?
We travel a lot. So we've got family in many parts of the world. We have friends in many parts of the world. I've gotten used to being, you know, I jokingly say I was jet lagged for 25 years. I've just gotten used to the movement of time zones, et cetera. But, you know, I'm not sure what a global citizen actually means, but I just think that there's a kind of a combination of your experiences and how that creates sort of a sense of understanding and empathy. You know, one of the biggest mistakes people make, certainly if you're a native English speaker, is that you try and do a proxy of English skill to intelligence. And that if people are not that skilled in English, suddenly you just you discount the perception of
exactly
their intellect.
Like me, who has accent.
and I didn't even notice.
And so for me, I speak Japanese. You know, I have felt dismissed when people were thinking maybe my Japanese wasn't as fluent as it needed to be. And I think that means that you're more empathetic to people who have English as a second language. Mm-hmm. That it's very hard to learn a second language, especially as an adult. So, you know, my daughters are bilingual, mm-hmm. you know, from birth they were learning Japanese and English. But if they wanted to learn a third language, they would be far more empathetic than certainly maybe other people are towards them.
That's are you going to take them to Buford Highway?
Buford Highway.
There's a lot of languages on Buford Highway.
Right. Yeah. So what was your impression that when you were out for 25 years, then you came back to your real own country? What did you...
Anything see? Change?
Well, nothing and everything. So, you know, we came frequently to visit because my folks were here. Do you know, that's a really interesting question. It feels to me that the United States became broadly much more international. I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a suburb called Edina. And in my high school, everyone was Scandinavian, right? So, you know, I'm dark haired, so I kind of stuck out as a minority because everyone was blonde. It was still, the U.S. was still very much compartmentalized, it felt, even in a city like, you know, Minneapolis. I mean, today you go to Minneapolis and it's another global city, much like Atlanta at one time would have looked like that. So I think in the last 25 years, it's the globalization of the United States. And that's the first. The second is how much more mobile Americans are. You know, when I was growing up, a house being sold in the neighborhood was a once in a decade kind of an event where, you know, it nowadays Americans for careers are so mobile that they're moving around, et cetera. So that feels different. And the flip side of that is then maybe sense of community gets challenged, right? You know, the sense of a neighborhood, people don't necessarily know who their neighbors are. And that does change the dynamics.
Now, when you were traveling internationally, were you able to feel that sense of community in the places you were?
Do you know, the expat community is actually quite strong because inherent in it being transitional, there's sort of this immediate shared sense of experience and the need for friendship, especially, you know, if you're trying to raise your kids in Singapore, for example, where we lived for a while, where you still want them to have the American experience, the expat families come together and do Halloween, right? And so, you know, you'll show up on the 1st of August through the school, you have an immediate group of friends, and then you're immediately creating these experiences. So there was a real sense of community amongst the expats, I always felt, in all the six countries that we lived.
Now, are you seeing going back to the business side a little bit, how young people aren't as attached to their vehicles? Like in our generation, like a car was a big moment. That was like, I look forward to having a car and that's my, you know, independence and freedom and things like that. And in today's world where young people don't have that emotional connection to their vehicle, do you think that that's kind of greased the skids for this autonomous vehicles and this kind of, I'm going to just have a subscription to a car service that's going to pick me up and drop me off?
Do you know, I would actually take that to a step further, Lee, which is to say, I think youngsters see things more as disposable than necessarily how we would
like
have grown
up. Like we have to own them and have stuff.
It's not only own them, but they're things that you keep, right? You know, so if I look at, you know, I look at sort of our stage in life and how many boxes of stuff we have over the last, you know.
Especially you've traveled, moved a lot.
So yeah, it's like you want to have 27 years of marriage and my wife is a bit of a pack rat. And if she hears it, she's really annoyed with me. But if I look at the way my daughters live, so my oldest daughter's 25, lives in New York City. And, you know, fashion to her is something that is transient, right? So there's multiple websites where you buy and sell things right. for a couple of times. Mm. She doesn't actually keep, you know, we've got 18 boxes of photographs. My wife refuses to give up. My daughter wouldn't even consider doing something like keeping that, right? Because right. of the cloud. Mm. A car is another example of that. It wouldn't even occur to her to invest her, you know, resources into a vehicle when between Uber, Lyft, and taxis, you don't need to do that in a city like New York. At some point, that'll be the same as Atlanta. It'll be the same even maybe even suburban areas where cars and this sort of ownership becomes much more of a variable than necessarily fixed mentality.
So now how does UPS kind of process that? Like, are they saying, I want to use other people's vehicles, or is it always going to be UPS's vehicles?
So, you know, we, a part of this whole transformation is the fact that we continue to build our innovation pipeline. And so as a company, we've had innovation. And so yesterday we had another internal big pitch session. So we bring together, and we had, I think, 81 entrants of 4 to 5 UPS employees come together with an idea, and they're looking for seed right. funds.
Right.
And several of the ones that we presented yesterday were along this concept, which is, well, how does UPS start to engage with that future behavior? So, you know, when it comes to gig drivers, I think, you know, there's a misnomer that people just look at the flexibility of it without understanding how important the cost is dependent upon the efficiency. So a gig driver goes and picks up something and delivers potentially 2 boxes an hour, whereas in a highly dense area with a high level of efficiency, a huge amount of smart logistics network that we've invested in
right,
technology.
Right, which is your superpower.
One of our drivers right. can deliver 180 boxes.
right.
And so, you know, at some point the economics work out that, in fact, we think that we've got a very, very solid proposition for many, many years. But we also have to understand there's other ways to grow. So, for example, back to this point, you know, people want things to be stored, but they don't want to keep them in their house because they have limited storage.
But they want them when they want them.
They want them when they want them. So if you think about, you know, the whole old, you know, storage unit mentality, that's becoming gig. That's becoming variable, right? I mean, there's ways for people now to start creating business models that you wouldn't have even thought of 20 years ago.
And you're really, we've had in here Roadie. That's one of your investments.
One of our investments, that's right.
Right, that was an entrepreneur who has that kind of peer-to-peer.
Sure, sure. And Where to Go is another one that we've launched here. And in fact, we've launched it in Atlanta. And we, you know, it was created on the West Coast. And there's sort of this sense that the West Coast is the birthplace of technology. And the reality is that cities like Atlanta, with investments in the technology capability, so Georgia Tech obviously putting out a lot of engineers, the infrastructure, so the Atlanta Tech Village, et cetera. So we actually, for our major launch, took that seed and we brought it to Atlanta. Where to Go is basically the Airbnb of warehousing. You know, there's millions and millions of square feet of warehousing that exists in the United States.
That's underutilized.
That's underutilized at multiple parts during the year. And if you're a small business, it's nearly impossible for you to find that and contract it because they want, you know, 2 and 3 month, if not right. 2 to 3 years. We take over and basically we connect supply and demand. It's basically, you know, warehousing Tinder, you know, here's one, here's another, you match them and,
that's,
you know,
right.
we take a fee from that process. So Where to Go, something that we launched, we think is another example
that's
of
a great
innovation.
Idea. Yes.
So what do you teach to youngsters? Or if you see yourself when you are 20 years old, what would you tell you?
Just calm down, right? I mean, just chill out. You know, there's, I had a lot of ambition and wanted to do a lot of things in life, and I overly stressed myself out. So probably just be a little calmer about the situation. And I think the second is, and I continue to validate this, you have to be willing to take risks. You know, I at multiple points in my career felt like that I had leveled off and I wanted to do more. Mm-hmm. It would have been easier to just stick with it and get frustrated. But I was willing to, you know, look around and risk. And, you know, especially when you're an expat, you're heavily dependent upon your company because they pay your rent, they organize your life, et cetera. So moving from one company to another company has a lot of risks. And so, you know, be willing to take those risks is the first thing. And the second thing is that when it comes to your career development, companies are naturally self-interested in your movement. You have to be clear what your objective is in your career. And if something doesn't feel right, you have to feel brave enough to say, no, this is not what I want to do. I've met so many people who feel like they did a couple of jobs that they really didn't want to do. And I've kind of had conversations. They say, well, the company owes me. I'm like, yeah, they pay that debt every 2 weeks. So the reality is there's nothing beyond that. You really do have to take responsibility for your own career.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah.
So now, what do you have ahead? Are you still in the learning stage, getting kind of the lay of the land, or are you now ready to implement some of the ideas?
Well, I think I've been learning for 30 years, so that's a never-ending process. And I say that quite sincerely that, you know, maybe another piece of advice back to Junko's question, which is, you know, you have to own your own development, your own learning. You know, it's everyone hears around things like blockchain and the cloud, et cetera. The vast majority of people don't actually educate themselves as to what it actually means. How does blockchain work? What is a hyperledger? So you have to own your own development. You have to educate yourself. Wikipedia and the internet are very powerful in terms of self-education. For what's next, we just did an investor conference in New York a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about what's next. We very much are around that growth and that cost and that talent and culture. We have a very robust three-year program laid out. So what's next is just the very timely and well-executed implementation of all of that while we continue to serve our customers.
Now, what about you personally as you acclimate to living here in Atlanta?
So it would be really great if I got time to be able to learn how to play golf well.
And so that's on your bucket list.
That's on my bucket list. I've been told it takes 1,000 hours. I've mapped the first 82 hours. I'm not sure I'm going to get the other 918.
Yeah. What do you do? So golf and then to...
So my wife and I love the arts. So we're already the Alliance Theater at Woodruff. We're looking at the Sandy Springs Art Center. We love to get to museums. So we travel a lot to see museums. So we go to New York quite often. There's a lot to do. You know, I'm a big fan of history in the United States, and I love presidential history. So I've also studied it. And I spent years collecting a document from every U.S. president while they were in the White House, a signed document or something.
Oh, that's a great collection.
You know, the Carter Museum is to me very powerful, right? To have it so close. So, there's so many things to do in Atlanta. So we've got years.
You could go
tours
for Carter in Plains. He does a service, Sunday school service, so you can go and just go and watch.
Yeah, I'm afraid I might get lectured.
Just stand there. Have you gone, Katie?
Yeah, great.
No. I haven't gone, but I know a lot of friends that have gone. And
Max
they
went.
They
I didn't know he did that. That's really cool.
You can just show up and you just wait in line, and then he does the Sunday school.
What
service.
A great example of giving back at his age.
At his
still
age,
that
right.
engaged.
In the 90s.
It's a great model.
So,
So if somebody wants to learn more about UPS, what's the best way to keep up with you and your work?
Well, www.ups.com. We're also on Instagram. So
Instagram,
feel free to follow
UPS.
Us.
Yeah, I didn't know
Instagram,
that.
UPS. I'm a follower. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. We are technologically savvy.
And then you're very startup friendly.
We're very startup friendly.
Right. So you're always looking for new ideas and things like that.
We always talk to startups.
Yeah. And you're active in the startup community here in Atlanta.
We are in the East Coast and the West Coast. We have a head of an enterprise venture fund that reports up into my part of the organization that is constantly looking for new innovative ways for us to invest in the future.
And your UPS stores are the hub of small business in the markets they serve.
They're a great access point for small businesses to be able to connect to the world. Yes, very much.
Great.
So,
thank you, Scott.
It
was wonderful.
Junko.
Yeah, learned a lot. So,
all right. Next up on
Sebastian.
Yeah. All right.
Nice. The partner from Baker Donaldson Atlanta office. Welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me, Junko.
Did you learn anything there? Scott's pretty smart.
He is.
My turn to learn now.
Okay. So you are born here? Or?
I was actually born in Brazil. My father worked for a German company and was in the business development department, so he traveled a lot. And mm-hmm. so I was born during one of his foreign assignments that was Brazil.
I see. So you are Brazilian? Or?
Yes. I have a Brazilian passport.
As a German?
Yes.
So
and U.S. citizen as well. Wow. Mm.
A little of everything.
Yeah.
Welcome to America.
Yeah. So you can speak the language too, three.
No, I don't speak Portuguese. I was a year old when we moved back to Germany.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. And what made you decide to go to law?
After I graduated from law school in Germany, I was trying to figure out what to do. I was very interested in history and philosophy, but I didn't want to become a teacher. So that was a little bit of an issue. And so one of my mentors as a child growing up was my uncle, and he was an attorney. Mm. So I got to experience his daily job, and I was kind of fascinated it. And so that's why I decided to go to law school.
Wow. Is German law school like that? Is that experience similar to American law school?
No, it's kind of completely different. So in Germany, after you graduate from law school, after you graduate from high school, you can start law school right away. So we don't get an undergraduate degree. Oh. So that's a 4 or 5 year program.
Of just law?
Just law.
So in high school, you're deciding I'm going to be a lawyer, and then you're going kind mm-hmm. of all in right at that point?
Yes.
Wow.
So what made you do that? Like in high school, you know?
Because of his uncle.
Yeah, you know, I also thought that, you know, I would have, you know, several opportunities, you know, with a law degree. And then I also found out the law school that I attended had a new program, which was also focused on foreign languages. Uh-huh. So I did, you know, the regular German law program and also American law for 2 years. And as part of that, you know, they required you to do an internship abroad, which I liked. Uh-huh. And so that's when I came to the U.S., to New York, actually, for 2 months and did an internship there.
Oh, when was that?
Back in 98.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression? Was that your first trip to America? Or?
No, it was not my first trip. It was the first time in New York. Yeah. And I stayed with a family in New Jersey and did the commute. Uh-huh. I was fascinated and, you know, really liked it. And of course, it was completely different from anything I'd seen in Europe.
Mm. Well, what to explain? That?
How well, just the pace of life mm-hmm. and, you know, just the amount of people there. And, you know, my mother is Japanese, so mm-hmm. I've been to Japan many, many times, even as a child. And so I know what Tokyo looks like, but it's still different. Mm-hmm. And so back then I thought, oh, maybe I'll come back someday and live here. But that kind of changed then after a couple of years.
I see.
So you started your career working in Germany?
Yes. So I started my career in Munich, worked there for a law firm that had an office in Munich and also here in Atlanta. And so then after a year, a little more than a year, I transferred here to the Atlanta office.
So now do you have to kind of relearn the American law?
Yeah. It's very, very complicated, the entire system. So I was able to actually learn, you know, how the whole admission process works. But, I had to take the Georgia bar exam.
But you didn't have to go to law school again.
Not really, because I did an master or an LLM program in New Zealand for a year. And then I also did the American program in Germany for 2 years. And so all of that taken into consideration, you know, there's a process. And I did go to law school here part-time just to take classes and, you know, take some courses.
Now, when you're looking at the law or learning the law here, are you in your head as a German and you're translating it?
Not anymore, no. And also really in the area where I practice, it's mainly corporate. The law is not that different. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm only dealing with transactions. I'm not doing any litigation work. So the way it works in Germany and in the United States is really not
that similar.
Yeah, it's kind of similar, yes.
So now, how did you decide a specialty?
When I practiced in Munich, a lot of our clients were American companies and also UK companies in having their business in Germany. And a lot of it was based to, you know, cross-border transactions and acquisitions in Germany. So that's kind of like where I started. That was very, very easy to, you know, transfer, or it was easy for me to transfer also here to the Atlanta office and kind of like doing the similar work, but now for mainly German-speaking companies here in the United States. So I would say 80% of my clients are based in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and they
and
have...
And you're helping them do business in America?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you wanted to come here, or what brought you? What? How did you come to this country?
I think ultimately it was my wife. My wife is from Atlanta, and we met while we were both studying abroad.
Oh, I see.
And she was in Baltimore for a few years and then also came back to Atlanta.
Oh.
So when she told you or when you decided to come to Atlanta, were you like, yay? Or were you like, oh, great.
No, I was...
South?
No, I was... I didn't really know.
Preconceptions?
I had met her family before. So, yeah. And since her family is really from Atlanta... and I met the entire family. You know, there were a couple of weddings that I attended, so some very memorable events there. But I always had the idea, even when I went to law school in Germany, that I wanted to work abroad. I didn't have the plan to work abroad forever, but I definitely wanted that international experience. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have any specific plans going to the United States. Quite honestly, I kind of like had the idea of maybe working in Japan for a couple of years. My mother is Japanese, and I did an extended internship in Tokyo and was with a law firm there, and they wanted to hire me. But then I met my wife, and everything shifted kind of like from east to west.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, so it was kind of difficult to tell them that, you know, that plan had changed. Yeah. But it was... Even when I did that internship, what I found fascinating was working with, you know, international companies, helping with their business, because it's not just, you know, the purely legal work. You help them with the cultural challenges here in the country, you know, things that Scott mentioned, you know, you learn the culture. And so it's so much more than just giving legal advice.
So like an example, if somebody's thinking of relocating a portion of their business to America, if they're coming to Atlanta specifically, you're kind of giving them the heads up of, okay, this part of town's probably a good fit. There's stuff like, here's some restaurants. Like, is it to that kind of level where they, yeah. Cause that's part of the decision, right? If they're going to America's big.
Yeah. I'm very fortunate. As Scott mentioned before, Atlanta is, I think, a great place to do business. And very rarely I'm in a situation where I have to convince a company to come here. They usually say, we looked at Atlanta, we like it. You know, the airport is here. Yes, traffic is pretty bad, but you know, we have an international school that's sometimes important for families.
Interesting.
There's already a big international community, arts here, sports. You know, a lot of my German clients are very excited about Atlanta United. You know, they tell me we joined the fan club right away. And
a lot of people did that. Place sells out every game.
Yes, I was there. It's fascinating. But so the city in itself for me is very easy to sell. But yes, I mean, they have questions like, you know, what do we do if we have an expat? You know, can you help us connecting us with other people and service providers? So that's certainly what we do. And then, of course, on the business side, there are a lot of aspects that the companies, you know, have to decide beforehand. Of course, anytime they ask me, you know, what kind of additional advice I can provide, we usually try to sell, and we are a full service firm and we have offices throughout the entire South. So, you know, usually we have very, very good resources. But yeah, I mean, they come up with all kinds of questions that are absolutely not related to any legal projects or questions.
Are there a lot of German firms in Atlanta?
You mean companies? Or?
Yeah.
Yes. So many people probably don't know. And of course, there's always discussion about, like, you know, what is the number one city? I think Atlanta is probably really one of the largest cities in the United States with the biggest German community.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So and one indication for that is the German American Chamber that has a pretty strong presence here. Their membership is growing every year. And of course, because of the automotive industry, Mercedes, Porsche, BMW, VW, they're all about 2 hours away from Atlanta. So Atlanta is a great place to start. Mm-hmm. And that has been, you know, of course, a huge magnet for German companies. But in addition to that, also in the healthcare, IT industry, there are a lot of German companies coming to Atlanta.
Well,
or even relocating. You know, a lot of them start out in New York, and then after a couple of years, they understand it's really, really expensive, and the benefits are really not that significant.
Yeah.
So they relocate to Atlanta.
I see. So let me ask, what was that like, that to have a German father, a Japanese mother, and growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like thankful that when I grew up in Germany, we didn't really have to travel that much. My father continued working abroad for significant periods of time. You know, he was in Hong Kong for several years. He was in India. My mother was very focused on our education and how we grow up. A lot of her friends traveled around, and she decided that if possible, we would stay in Germany and not continue the international travel. But of course, because my father was abroad, you know, I traveled a lot with my mom and my sister, so to Asia.
But your domain was Germany.
Yeah.
So your father lived outside.
Yeah, for certain periods of time, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
But it was also exciting for us because, you know, we would visit him and see other places, especially in Asia, like Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Taiwan.
Yeah.
And that was always a lot of fun because we would travel then with his business partners and did, you know, felt very authentic.
I see.
Now, Scott mentioned that he felt like an outsider in some places. Where do you feel like most comfortable?
Probably when I came to the U.S., I felt more like a European rather than really a German. You know, that's, I think, for people in the U.S. still sometimes difficult to understand how tight really the European community is. But I think especially with young people, that's true. When I was in Japan for, you know, a couple of months and I tried to figure out if this is a place where I could live, I also felt like an outsider. I mean, even though I'm half Japanese, I'm significantly taller than, you know, the average man there. And of course, they also see that I'm not 100% Japanese. So I made the same or similar experience that Scott had. You know, every time I talked to someone in Japanese, they would try to respond in English or they would look at me and, you know, or if I would go somewhere with a friend, they would always like look at us and say, oh, is this a couple or, you know, this looks strange. But you know, quite honestly, when I grew up in Germany, as half German, half Japanese, that's kind of like the experience that I had there. I grew up in a small town. My mother was for sure the only Japanese person there for decades, probably still is. And I mean, obviously, you know, Germany has a lot of foreigners that came, you know, during different periods in time. But there were certain times that were challenging, you know, as growing up as someone that looked different. So
now you are in America. How do you feel? And what's the difference you feel here and Europe?
Well, I mean, for me, it was a process to understand that the United States, you know, in itself consists of so many different areas and different cultures. And that's something that I see with my clients as well. When they come here, they say, oh, okay, I think we understand how the market works. And, you know, then they understand after years that West Coast and Northeast and Midwest and South are all kind of like their own business regions with different standards and everything. So that was also for me a process to understand. And then fairly soon, I don't know if I was told, but I also found out that certain topics are probably not that common to discuss during social events like politics and other things, which are kind of like standard in Germany. You know, it's not a taboo to do that.
Yeah.
Probably not the best idea to do that here in the United States.
I see. Yeah.
So now, when you were living outside of America, did people think of America as kind of as one place?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, they basically say, we are from Germany. Now we're going to a different country, which is the United States. And I tell them, you have to see the United States kind of like as the equivalent of the European Union, consisting of, you know, more than 20 countries. And that's the other thing. Atlanta has done a fairly good job, or the state of Georgia, you know, promoting itself. But still, a lot of companies in Europe, when they talk about the United States, they think of New York, Washington, D.C., Miami, Texas. San Francisco, That's kind of like, you know, in the forefront. And they have no idea whether that would be a good place for their actual business.
But obviously, George is doing something right. There's so many international businesses coming or headquartering here.
Yeah, so they're doing a tremendous job. You know, the Department of Economic Development has been very, very active. They have, you know, representations in Europe.
Right.
And they also have some very, very strong competition here in the South. So the Carolinas are really aggressive. Right. You know, Tennessee,
Nashville's
Alabama.
Growing.
Yes.
Dramatically.
Yeah.
Now, our company got to do the... radio at FinTech South, which is financial technology conference that was here. And we had the opportunity to interview a lot of global companies. And I asked them a similar question about when they told, you know, their colleagues, like, hey, I'm going to this big FinTech conference. And they all assumed it was like in New York or, and then they're like, no, it's in Atlanta. And, you know, like they couldn't, they didn't get it. Is that a problem, or you think it's less of a problem now?
No, it's. I don't think it's a problem. I mean, once companies really get into the process of looking for the right location in the United States, Atlanta is always, you know,
it's one on of a the, short list, but yes. it's not the first thing that comes to mind.
No,
that's the problem, I guess.
Yes,
from a branding standpoint for the city.
Yeah, but I think that's not only true for companies. I mean, we even see that with big organizations. Let's say if you talk about trade organizations, trade associations, or let's say organizations like the American Chamber in Germany, which is one of the oldest organizations in Germany, supporting the relationship between Germany and the United States. It was almost impossible for us to explain to them that Atlanta would be also a good place for a conference. You know, they would always go to New York or DC. And once they understood how big the German community is here, they were fascinated. They were like, oh, there's so many companies here. What are they all doing? How did they get here? So it's, you know, again, it's a little bit of a process, but I think again, Atlanta and Georgia are doing a great job, and companies and states and cities are definitely aware of it.
Now in your role, are you, involved once the company decides to come to America, or are you helping companies decide to come and set up here and work with them here?
Yeah, I usually get involved fairly early. So in most cases, before they're actually here. Once they're here, it's kind of like too late for me because I know they have someone else.
Right.
And that's also one reason why I have to travel and, you know, participate in events and conferences in Germany fairly frequently.
So then in Germany, you're speaking at conferences?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then about how they can grow more in America and there's opportunity there? So
yeah.
this is a lot of times the first time that they left Germany to come to America?
Yes, most of the companies already have significant business here, so usually direct exports.
But they don't have an actual.
They don't usually have an office or a business operations here. And then, you know, once they exceed a certain threshold, then the management says, okay, now it's worth for us to make that investment and come here. Mm-hmm. And the conferences are usually a platform where, for example, Georgia Department of Economic Development is also there, presents German American Chamber, because we just try to explain to them there are so many different things they have to consider.
Right.
And it's a fairly complex process. One thing that I see now is that because of, you know, the changing landscape and e-commerce and everything, it's a lot easier for small companies to make that decision and go to the US because they can use the existing infrastructure and don't have to spend their own money. In the old days, I would say, you know, that was a big decision for, let's say, a mid-sized company to put up that investment and say, listen, now we have to have, you know, a certain number of employees there and build up our platform there.
Right.
So especially Berlin in Germany has a very, very vibrant startup scene. And a lot of the businesses there use e-commerce kind of like as the initial platform. And that helps them grow extremely fast in the U.S.
So then you help them with that transition?
Yes. You know, I help them, you know, getting established here. And then, of course, we work with CPAs and other service providers just to basically help them to get ready and then launch their product or whatever they have for the United States.
So you're quite busy going back and forth. And what do you do for yourself to keep your health and.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a almost 4-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. so and my wife travels pretty extensively as well, mm-hmm. so my trips are now much shorter. Mm-hmm. So I'm usually gone for less than a week,
oh.
and but I go more often.
Yeah,
and you know, we really enjoy any kind of outdoor activity. We're mm-hmm. fairly active. I used to play a lot of golf. Kind of like stopped about 4 years ago when we had our daughter.
Yeah, life so, changed.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's great. Yeah.
So now the perfect company for you, though, is a company in Germany that is considering relocating to America?
Yeah, either that or we also have a lot of companies that have already been in the United States for 10, 20, 30 years, and they have some, you know, changing event within the company, a management change or owner change or something, and then we help them restructuring their business. Or even sometimes they're relocating or getting to the next stage where they're building a manufacturing plant. You know, so it's not only the what we call the inbound business companies coming here, mm-hmm. but also existing companies yeah. that expand.
I see. And what kind of advice do you give if you see younger people to motivate them or to, you know, to look back about yourself and then give advice to younger generations?
I would tell them that, you know, getting a proper education is important, but I always try to encourage them also to, you know, travel the world and see the world. Mm. I really enjoyed doing that, and I think it really helped expanding my horizon and seeing and understanding different cultures. Mm-hmm. One thing that I see fairly often is that, you know, when people come back from somewhere, they always come back and say, oh, we saw that. That's so different. And, you know, they always compare, mm-hmm. but they don't understand why things are different. Mm-hmm. And you will never really understand or get a good feeling for a different culture if you don't understand why or if you don't ask why, mm-hmm. you know, and that's also what I see here. So I always try to also to explain young people that, you know, try to understand and not compare.
Mm.
Especially here in the United States, giving young people the chance to travel, spending time abroad. I'm not talking about going to Europe for 1 week and seeing 10 countries, mm. you know. Mm. But
also, when you travel, do you travel maybe differently than a tourist would travel, like where you're seeing like the things on the brochure? You're going to try to understand more the culture and the community and see the kind of the off the beaten path stuff to really understand.
I don't think that's necessary. I think it's kind of like the attitude and the expectation that you have to have, you know, with these travels. You know, for example, what I always enjoyed when I tried to organize my travel was always to find out if my family had friends or relatives or someone that mm-hmm. I could visit there. That's always, of course, a huge advantage. I know that not everyone has that, but what I see, and I told Junko that about 8-9 years ago with one of my partners, Christoph Rückel, we started a German-American internship program. UPS is one of our biggest supporters mm-hmm. in Germany. So they take 2 or 3 American interns every year. There's mm-hmm. you know, students that go to one of the universities here. Mm-hmm. But that was a life-changing event for these students. And really for most of them, that's the first time they actually leave the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And giving them the opportunity to go to Germany for 3 months, staying with a company that's based in Germany. It's not always a German company. And then they come really back as young ambassadors. You know, they can tell people, I was in Germany, I understand the culture. I was actually in Europe and I understand the European culture. And they can maybe also mm-hmm. give people here a different perspective on certain issues. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of interns that asked us, what about the refugee crisis? Is it still safe to go or not? And we said, of course it's safe. Mm-hmm. See it for yourself. And they came back and said, yeah, yes, we did see them. And we understand it's a big challenge for Germany, but it was actually interesting. We talked to some of them and understand the situation that they were in Syria, Afghanistan, or wherever they were from. So just giving them the opportunity to, you know, form their own opinion is so important.
That was similar to what happened to you when you came to America in New Jersey?
Kind of, yeah. No, it really was.
That's true.
Yeah.
And then you were able to take that and then institute a similar thing for your company now?
Well, I think if I had not traveled, I would not have really had, you know, gained the interest in really going or living abroad. You know, I think you have to have that exposure. And so that's why I'm so thankful that my parents gave me the opportunity.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So if somebody wants to learn more about your work at Baker Donaldson, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Either go to our website, BakerDonaldson.com. I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, and my email is also listed on our website. Always happy to help out.
Great. Thank you so much. Well, great guest, Scott and Sebastian. Really appreciate that.
Great job, Junko. Yeah.
Thank you.
You always bring the most interesting people.
Thank you.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Junko Horvath. This is Junko's Health, Wealth, and Happiness Hour, brought to you by our good friends at Fujiyama Wealth Management.
Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Registered representative, securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Investment Advisor Representative, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Fujiyama Wealth Management and Cambridge are not affiliated.